It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. Here we go. With Malia Jacobson as your host.
Hello, and welcome to Sleep Well, Stay Well. I'm your host, sleep and health journalist Malia Jacobson. Thank you so much for listening today. Welcome to new listeners. I hope that you're doing well and enjoying your December. Today's topic is one that I am excited to cover. It's one that I don't get to talk about very often, and that is smoking. Right now, we're all trying to be our healthiest, especially when it comes to our respiratory health. As one of my guests in today's episode says, there has never been a better time to quit smoking, but that's easier said than done. 1 in 5 U.S. adults smokes, and smoking affects cardiovascular health, immune health, and even sleep health. Smoking is the leading cause of preventable death in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and quitting is not easy. New research from the University of Arizona Health Sciences shows how getting a good night's sleep could be another tool to help people successfully quit smoking. Let's get my guests on the call. They have a lot of interesting insights into a health topic that really affects more people than you think and possibly could be affecting you or someone in your household. Let's get them on the line. Good morning. Today, my guests are Michael A. Grandner, PhD, and Associate Professor in the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Tucson, Department of Psychiatry, and Director of the Sleep and Health Research Program, and Dr. Elizabeth Connick, MD, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases in the College of Medicine, Tucson. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's an honor. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being here. And I imagine that this is such a busy time for both of you, busy month. And I'm very excited to have you both here. I think this might be one of my first interviews with more than one person at a time on the podcast. So this is exciting. And we were going to be joined by Frieda Patterson, PhD, a smoking cessation expert at the University of Delaware. She wasn't able to join us, but it does make it a little bit easier to interview just two people. I do interview doctors and researchers for a living, but usually not three at one time. So narrowing it down to two makes it a little bit easier. So you are here to tell us about your research around how a good night's sleep can help people quit smoking, which is very interesting. So first, I was chatting a few minutes before we started the recording with Dr. Grandner about why smoking is an important area to research and how this came about. So Dr. Grandner, can you talk a little bit about that? What got you interested in researching this area when your expertise and background are in sleep, and Dr. Connick for you in infectious medicine? What made you want to look into sleep and smoking?
Yeah, so this is a question that started a few years ago between Dr. Patterson and myself, where we've been collaborating for a bunch of years now on this issue of sleep and smoking, where, and I've learned a lot of this from her and some of the work that we've done in collaboration, but a lot of people think about smoking as something they do to relax, but rather than that, nicotine is actually a stimulant. And people who smoke, and we've known this for years in the epidemiology and population literature, that people who smoke tend not to sleep as well. And part of it may be because the people who are smoking are more stressed or whatever, and that's what's leading to sleep problems. Or it could actually be the nicotine itself that is a stimulant, especially if people are smoking at night. And so as we were digging into this a little further, into this question and sort of exploring it scientifically, there was a really interesting story that emerged that not only is nicotine a stimulant and smoking makes sleep worse, but the worse you sleep, the more likely that smokers are to smoke more. And the more you smoke, the worse your sleep is. Then when it comes to quitting, quitting smoking is hard and stressful. And the worse your sleep is, the harder it is to quit. Not only that, if you're trying to quit and your sleep gets much worse, and it becomes hard to handle, it makes it more likely you're going to relapse. And then on top of that, a lot of the treatments we use for smoking cessation itself, some of the medications or even the nicotine patches themselves, include stimulating medications, which make insomnia worse. So you have this perfect storm of poor sleep and smoking when you're trying to quit. Like, so, you know, smoking makes sleep worse. Worse sleep leads to more smoking, and it's harder to quit. When you're trying to quit, it makes sleep worse. And the worse your sleep is, the more likely you are to relapse. So we had this idea, Dr. Patterson and I, of what if we use sleep as a vehicle to help people quit smoking? Take everything we already know about smoking cessation and then add sleep to that mix. And does it help get things better? And so she led a study in Delaware looking at this question and found that actually, yes, it does. It actually worked really well. So then we had this idea of how do we scale this up and address a bigger problem? And so that's when I came to Dr. Connick. So as you know, on a separate story, and she can tell you more about this, where we'd been collaborating for some time on this issue of sleep and HIV, where, you know, people with HIV have more sleep issues and they're more likely to smoke. And she can speak to this, they're more likely to develop cardiovascular disease. And a lot of people think of sleep as as smoking as a lung issue, but it is, but smoking is also a cardiovascular issue. I mean, for people who smoke, if smoking is gonna kill you, it's much more likely due to heart disease than lung disease actually. And so it's one of the major causes of preventable death still in the United States. And then when you add HIV to the mix, it makes it even more important. And I'll let her talk about that.
Right. Thank you so much for explaining that. And although I'm not a smoker, I can definitely relate to the vicious cycle that comes when you're trying to change a habit or implement any type of healthy behavior. You're trying to eat better. You're trying to, you know, get more exercise, and you have a poor night's sleep or you run into a patch of insomnia. And it's such a setback, and it makes everything worse. It makes trying to make any type of positive change in your life so much more difficult when you're experiencing insomnia. So that's so interesting that there's that effect that happens when people are trying to quit smoking and then they can't sleep and it just sabotages their efforts. Yeah, definitely relatable. And one thing that came up for me was as a health journalist, I haven't had the opportunity to write about smoking all that much, at least with traditional cigarettes. But I have done quite a bit of work and writing in the prevention space around vaping and other tobacco products. Did your research look at those, or was it just traditional cigarettes that you were looking at?
Yeah, we're starting to look at that, but you know, so in terms of the research we've done, the one study that was led by Dr. Patterson in Delaware, where we added it to smoking cessation, that was regular cigarettes, or as they call them, combustibles, as opposed to the electronic. But that other work is going to be coming soon. I mean, hopefully, you know, we were able to get some funding for that, because it does look like it's a little bit different. And we're not exactly sure how yet, because it's so new. But then also we have a study that just got published we led from here in Arizona, looking at the timing of smoking and how it is impacting sleep. And one of the things that we found was that smoking on average is associated with worse sleep, but especially if people are smoking at night, again, sort of bridging that gap, that it's not just about the smoking, it's also about this tie-in with smoking at night that is important in that relationship. And then when you add this issue of HIV to the mix, it just makes it even more interesting, and there's a lot more in there as well.
Right, that's a really interesting connection that we will get into a little bit later. So your work around this started a few years ago. Can you talk briefly about how the events of this year and COVID impacted your research? I know many researchers found their efforts pivoted and efforts stalled, and things happening this year that they didn't anticipate. But it seems that this is such an important area of research to continue and focus on, especially now because of the importance of respiratory health and of course, infectious disease control. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, from my perspective, it's had a huge impact. I mean, some studies have had to get stopped altogether. Some studies have had to shift online, if we could make the more surveys. And the study that we're launching here with Dr. Connick and with Dr. Patterson and me here, we actually, you know, the timing was interesting where we got the notice that the NIH was funding our study right around the start of the pandemic. And so it was earlier in the year, and it's just taken this long where what we had to do is we got the great news that yes, you're going to be able to do this study, but you're going to have to totally redesign it to make it COVID compatible for now. Okay. Otherwise we're not going to be able to do it. So we sort of went back to the drawing board and said, all right, what is it that we're trying to do? And how do we, without adding any money to the budget, because you know we didn't have that flexibility, within the same budget, how do we now make the whole thing mobile, virtual, online, at least as much as possible? Where we couldn't do it 100%, but we did what we could to modify it. And this is what researchers all over are doing, where either they have to modify existing studies, which is hard, because if you have a study that's ongoing, you don't want to change something halfway through, because scientifically that might disrupt your results and you don't know whether it was because of the change or something else. So you have to either start it different or maybe pause or maybe change something that's not going to affect the outcome. So it's definitely been a huge challenge for research.
Right, Dr. Connick, this has to have been a roller coaster year for you in the Division of Infectious Diseases. Did COVID impact the work that you were doing in this area?
Absolutely. As Michael said, a lot of research has had to be revamped or paused. And we were actually doing a smoking survey of patients in clinic that had to be prematurely ended, unfortunately, because people were being interviewed in clinic and we couldn't really change the methodology halfway through the study. I have also pivoted and am involved in some clinical trials related to COVID as a result, even though I'm primarily an HIV researcher and that is what most of my life has been focused on. A lot of the clinical trials experience that I developed through doing HIV research is directly applicable to COVID clinical trials. So I've become involved in some of the treatment trials and may potentially be involved in a vaccine study soon.
Oh, that's exciting. And before we started the recording, Dr. Grindner was talking a little bit about what kind of motivated the interest in smoking as a topic. You know, Dr. Connick, you are an HIV researcher. Dr. Grindner, your expertise and background are in sleep. What got you both interested in researching smoking?
So I've been doing HIV research since the 1990s, before we even had effective antiviral therapy for HIV infection. I mean, the things that have happened, the development of potent antiviral therapy, which was essentially life-saving for people living with HIV, all this happened during my time as a researcher. So I've seen a lot of change. Now people living with HIV are living pretty normal lives, and they're no longer dying of HIV, but they're dying of good old-fashioned American diseases. And heart disease is one of the biggest killers. It's a big killer in the United States overall, and particularly in people living with HIV. And cigarette smoking is the single largest modifiable risk factor in people living with HIV for coronary artery disease. So I said, let's hit the most important thing. And I was really thrilled to meet Dr. Grindner and Dr. Patterson and to learn that they actually had an intervention for smoking cessation. And that is how our study came about. I said, why don't we implement your intervention in my patient population? So that's how our study came to be.
Thank you. And yeah, Dr. Grander, you had some great points too about how your background was in sleep and smoking just wasn't an area that came up very often for you.
Where I started out, so I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and my interest started in the overlap between sleep and mental health, and that's sort of how I got into this. But then over time, over the years, my work expanded from mental health into other aspects of health and well-being, because they're all connected. And then you start learning about how all the different ways sleep is related to cardiovascular and metabolic functioning. And so we call it cardiometabolic functioning because they're so interrelated. So people think of metabolism as energy and heart as this very different thing, but there's a very dynamic system in terms of how the heart function relates to metabolism and weight management and blood sugar. They're all intricately related. And then that's all tied in with the immune system and inflammation. I mean, we already know a lot of it from Eric Prather's awesome work at UCSF, showing that people who don't sleep well or don't sleep enough catch more colds, catch more viruses and flus. They get sick more, they get sicker, they get sick for longer. And actually vaccines don't even work as well in people who aren't sleeping well. And there's a reason why when we're sick, we should, you know, our instructions are not get out and get moving, it's lay down and get some rest. Because sleep and the immune system are so intricately connected. And so you have the immune function, which is very closely involved in metabolism and heart function. You have metabolism that's very involved in things like weight management and heart health. And then you have heart function, which is involved in everything from energy level and how the body can work to repair itself and be healthy, that are all connected. And that's all related to sleep. And so then when you take that and you take two elements, you have smoking, which, you know, I'm not a smoker, but I'm not that old yet, but I do remember growing up in the time of smoking sections and non-smoking sections, something kids clearly have no idea what I'm talking about, which is a good thing. And society has changed a lot in terms of smoking, but if you look at the numbers, you still have almost 1 in 5 US adults is still smoking. It's huge. It's still really huge. And it's still, and this is one of the things I learned from Dr. Patterson, is just how big of a problem this still is in terms of preventable death. And then you get to the HIV world where one of the things that Dr. Connick has done is look at overlaps between sleep and HIV, where most people who are HIV positive still have sleep problems. Maybe it's because of biological changes caused by HIV itself, and how sleep is related to the immune system itself. So here you have a condition where with smoking, which is related to sleep, because remember, it keeps you up, and is related to this cardiometabolic constellation of health issues that sleep is also related to. And then you have HIV, which is an immune system issue, but that's also tied into cardiovascular disease and also has its fingers in sleep health. So it seemed like a perfect way to bridge these three really important worlds.
Right, thank you. And so that does bring up a great point that we are actually talking about two different studies and some very kind of discrete areas of research that you are bridging. So can you talk about that a little bit? It is a little bit complicated. And we don't have Dr. Patterson here to describe her study, but Dr. Grander and Dr. Connick, I think you guys can give a good overview. And so from my understanding, that research came first. And then your study bridged onto that. So can you unpack that a little bit for listeners?
Sure. I'll let Dr. Connick talk about the work that she did looking at HIV and sleep. I'll talk a little bit about the work that Dr. Patterson and I did with sleep and smoking, where we started out looking at population trends on sleep health and other behavioral risk factors, things that people do that promote health or get in the way of health. And one of the things that we found was at the population level, there are these overlaps between sleep and smoking. And then that's where we started digging into this issue of like why and what can we do about it. And so one study we had just wrapped up, so that was recently published, where that was what I was mentioning before, the study where we took smokers, and by we, I mean mostly she, because this was in Delaware, but we developed this together, where we put the smokers through a gold standard, the best smoking cessation program we could design in terms of it's got counseling sessions, the medication, and all this stuff. And they all got that. Half of them also got a sleep intervention that we designed, which essentially what it does is it takes people where they're at. For people who it was flexible. Where if people came in with sleep problems, because remember, smokers more likely to have sleep problems, we would get those treated and deal with them. If they didn't have sleep problems, what we would do is we would prepare them for potentially inevitable sleep problems that may be coming down the road. So we would inoculate them and we would teach them how to preserve whatever good sleep they had. And then through the smoking cessation process, we would meet with them regularly. And while we're dealing with smoking cessation, we also dealt with their sleep issues along the way. So if they started getting sleep deprived, we would help them get more sleep. If they started getting insomnia, we would help them fall asleep faster and stay asleep more during the night if they had more broken up sleep, things like that. So we dealt with the problems as they came up, prepared them for them before they even started, and sort of held their hand through it. The other group got just as much attention, but it wasn't focused on sleep. It was just focused on just other general health and wellness issues to see. It's not about the attention, extra attention and time. It was about the sleep component. And we found that the ability for people to quit went up by quite a bit in the people who were in the smoking group. And so then that's what gave us the idea of upscaling this and seeing if we can take this to a slightly bigger group and potentially one that's even more sensitive to some of these issues, like an HIV population. And so I'll let Dr. Connor talk about where her background in this came from.
I don't have a long background in HIV and sleep, but after meeting Dr. Grandner, I became much more interested in it. And I had previously actually had a grant that's ongoing to look at the impact of poor sleep in people with HIV on their arterial function. And then Dr. Grander and Dr. Patterson and I did an investigation of an existing data set, the National College Health Assessment, which surveys college students about a variety of factors, including sleep and smoking. And in our data analysis, we found that HIV positive college students were more likely to smoke and were more likely to experience sleep difficulties. And when we looked at the relationship between HIV status and sleep difficulties, they were seen most strongly in the smokers. So I mentioned to you as well that we started to do a survey of our own clinic patients to learn about their smoking habits and their sleep patterns. And those data haven't been completely analyzed, but one of the most important things we found was that actually almost all the smokers said they wanted to quit, which is really surprising if you think about it. But almost everybody said that they wanted to quit. Almost everybody said that they wanted to take a pill, they'd be willing to take a pill. And almost everyone said they would be interested in, you know, an intervention to the counseling sessions to improve their sleep. So those surveys really established the feasibility of doing this study. I mean, I think a lot more needs to be learned about sleep and smoking in people living with HIV. But we hope that this will be coming out of our studies.
And Dr. Connick, your study, can you talk a little bit more about your study? It is the sleep training approach to reducing smoking funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Can you talk about how the study led by Dr. Patterson bridged into this study and what is happening with the STARS study now?
So first, I have to emphasize, it's not my study. It's Dr. Grander, Dr. Patterson's in my study. We're all the chiefs on it. We each contribute expertise. And it's really modeled upon the smoking intervention that Dr. Patterson developed in collaboration with Dr. Grander. So the what I bring to the study is the patient population who I work with and my knowledge and experience with doing clinical trials in those individuals. And we have not started recruitment yet. We were just about to when the most recent surge erupted. So we have paused recruitment. We're hoping we'll be able to start recruitment in February or March, depending upon how long the current surge lasts. But we're very excited to get going.
Thank you. And Dr. Grander, your study that you were mentioning, the patients that received education around sleeping, can you talk about the interventions that were used? You mentioned that people received help, both preventative and also help if they were experiencing insomnia. Were those interventions in the kind of more in the patient education realm? What were those methods that you were using to help people in your study who were experiencing the sleep problems or the preventative approaches that you were taking?
Yeah, that's a good question. Where this whole idea of the STARS acronym, the sleep training approach to reducing smoking, were really what it was. It had a couple of tools in it. One of the tools was modeled after cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia. And so the brief description of what that is. So insomnia is very common in the population. About 1 out of 3 people in the US population has some insomnia symptoms. About 1 in 10 might actually meet criteria for an insomnia disorder diagnosis that might need to get treated. Just most people don't know about it or don't get it treated. And the main treatment for insomnia, most people know about medications and sleeping pills, but what a lot of people don't realize is that the recommended treatment for insomnia above sleeping pills is actually this thing called cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. And what CBTI is essentially, in a nutshell, it's more of a training program than a therapy, where it essentially reteaches your brain how to sleep when it loses the ability to sleep on its own. And so by reteaching your brain how to sleep, it's actually shockingly effective and tends to work as well or even sometimes better than prescription medications without the same sort of side effect profile. And it tends to last essentially indefinitely because it teaches you how to do it. And so when you have new problems, it teaches you what to do in the face of those problems. So anyway, so CBTI has been around for decades. It's actually really well studied and has a few techniques within it. And what we did is we took some of those techniques and inserted them here, where one of the things that we did was that we helped promote that training in people who had some of these insomnia problems. But one of the things that we did that was a little different was, even if they didn't have problems with insomnia, we started them on a lighter version of the training anyway, so that they were ready and they were coming from a place of strength. Even if their sleep was fine for now, what we did is we helped set them up for better sleep using some of these cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia techniques. And then what we did, which with the techniques, by the way, they're not not sleep hygiene, not just like sleep tips. These are things like using people's own sleep data to help optimize when they should be in and out of bed is sort of a nutshell of how it works. So we did that. That helped inoculate some of the people who didn't yet have problems, but also helped deal with the problems that people walked in the door with. And then when people weren't getting enough sleep and were sleep deprived, we took an approach called systematic sleep time extension, which is something that I developed with a colleague of mine at the University of Pennsylvania, Michael Perlis, where essentially what that is we help people increase the amount of sleep time they get gradually by using an algorithm based on people, again, people's own sleep data. We use their own data to try and predict how quickly and how far can we get them to get a little more sleep, and when would their body be ready for it, and how could we help prep them so that they can get more sleep later. So there's, so using what we know about sleep-wake regulation, we came up with a strategy of how do we get people to get more sleep, irrespective of motivation, because people may want to get more sleep, they just feel they can't. But what these approaches do, whether it's the insomnia one or the getting more sleep one, it's all about using people's own data to help work with their own natural ability to increase the healthy sleep that they're getting. And then the one other element involved was sleep apnea, which is also highly underdiagnosed in the population. Probably 85% of cases never get diagnosed. So what we did is the first thing we did before we even enrolled people in this, we screened everybody for if they had sleep apnea, because it's more common in smokers anyway. And anyone who had sleep apnea, we made sure that they got treatment, and we made sure they stayed on their treatment through the study. So there are all these different tools that we pulled out that we sort of reconfigured into this adaptable, flexible approach to using what we know about sleep to help work people through the smoking cessation program.
Right. Thank you for explaining that. Yes. CBTI is a topic. Actually, it's one of my more popular episodes that I've recorded. I've interviewed and covered a number of, I've done a lot of reporting on CBTI and wanted to include that in the podcast. So early on, I had on one of my favorites, Vanessa Roddenberry, a researcher and practitioner, and she walked us through CBTI. A lot of people don't know it is the first line of treatment and more effective than medication. However, I will say there are not enough practitioners out there doing this work. So if researchers or practitioners are looking for an area to specialize in, we need more CBTI practitioners out there to work with people, because people get interested in this and they want to find someone, and then they can't find anyone. And that's frustrating.
Yeah, for sure.
And it is something that can be done remotely. And I think, as you mentioned, the interventions can be something that people can learn and pick up pretty quickly. And it doesn't have to be where you're in a practitioner's office for, you know, every week for months and months on end. You can just do a very short series of sessions and get some very actionable tactics that you can use. So it is a very, very great tool. So thank you for bringing that up. I did want to also talk a little bit. You mentioned that you've both mentioned that there's an overlap between smokers and people who have sleep problems, and then with the HIV positive population as well. Can you talk about this? Why, you know, is smoking itself stimulating? Of course, and then the approaches that people take to quitting, the patches and so forth, those have stimulants as well, you mentioned. What are those stimulants and what are the effects exactly that people are seeing? I think that's an important thing to bring up, especially with the treatment approaches that might cause sleep problems, because that comes up often and not just in smoking cessation. There's a lot of medications that people can take for different things, and they do impact sleep, and those things are almost never discussed. The doctor doesn't tell them that this medication is going to impact their sleep. They just experience effects and may make the connection or they may not. So can you talk a little bit about the stimulating effects that people experience, both from smoking and from the quitting efforts?
Yeah, I could talk about that a little bit. First, I want to highlight something you just said about this issue that of sleep, where it sort of gets pushed aside, where you'd think for something that's a fundamental part of our biology, that is a biological requirement for life, that we would take it a little more seriously. And you'd think, you know, every human since the first, you know, has slept every night, pretty much. You know, some of us have pulled all-nighters sometimes, but usually not. So pretty much every human has slept pretty much every night forever. You'd think that something like that, we'd be better at it. And we take it a little more seriously. But I mean, the thing is, we're unconscious when it happens. So we're not really aware of it. So it's easy to sort of forget about, but also we have this societal issue where we see sleep as unproductive time. And we have all these pressures to sideline sleep. Like, you never hear people say things like, you know what? Clean air is a luxury for people with too much free time. You know, you never hear things like, you know,
food is just a luxury.
Yeah. You know, we should say, like, you know, when I retire, I'm going to start drinking unpolluted water. You know, like, people don't say that. But we do for sleep. And I think that's one of these reasons why it gets forgotten. Patients don't bring it up with doctors. And when they do, so, you know, it often gets dismissed because the doctors often, you know, at least if you look at the data, they might take it seriously, but they don't even always know what to do about it. Besides give people a medication, they often give people the wrong ones, ones that aren't even recommended. So you have this issue with people, with sleep problems being very common, people not really knowing what to do about it. Then they start turning to solutions that are likely not going to work. Then they get discouraged when they don't work. Then they go to their doctor and the doctor doesn't really know what to do because they're not trained on it. And so then they give them other stuff that doesn't work. And so you get this sort of cycle of dissatisfaction, seeing it as potentially something permanent and why bother dealing with. But the truth is, we actually know a lot about sleep right now. So back to the question about the stimulating effects. So nicotine itself, you know, is just that nicotine itself is a stimulant, whether it's delivered, however it's delivered. So when you're using nicotine replacement, that's still a stimulant. The other thing is the medications. So the two most common medications for smoking cessation are bupropion and varenicline. Both of them impact neurotransmitter systems that, you know, reduce cravings and things. But on top of that, part of how they do is sort of through the dopamine system and some of these other neurotransmitter systems. And those same neurotransmitter systems also have roles in wakefulness. So that's the thing, like a neurotransmitter doesn't just do one thing. It's like a screwdriver. You know, you can use it to, you know, assemble something. You can also use it to work on your garage. You can also use it to, you know, pry open a can of paint. You can use it for lots of different things. And that's what the body does with these neurotransmitters. They're used for different things. So in addiction centers where you have things like dopamine and norepinephrine being very important, those same neurotransmitters are also important for sleep-wake regulation. So when you're boosting them and reducing things like cravings, you might also be inducing wakefulness. So that's why it's a very common side effect. And I don't know, I wouldn't be the first to say that quitting smoking is sort of worth some of these side effects because you're preventing so many worse things later. But what if, you know, was our idea, what if we could soften the blow a little bit? And even if you're going to get these side effects, how do we use that information rather than just throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, well, how do we actually use it?
Right. Thank you. That is a great explanation. Thank you. And, you know, this is such an interesting area. I could talk to you both so much longer. I wanted to give you an opportunity both to talk about just kind of outside of the study because of your expertise areas that are so topical and important right now. Can you just share some advice for how people can kind of protect their health, protect their sleep health, protect their respiratory health or their immune health during this season that we're in?
Well, I try to tell my patients there's no better time to quit than now.
Yes, absolutely.
A respiratory disease. But I defer to Dr. Grander on the sleep advice.
Yeah, and for right now, I would say just with everything going on, a lot of people are having a hard time detaching at night. That seems to be a thing that comes up a lot, whether it's with media, whether it's with just worries and stresses, or whether it's that your schedule got all thrown off. One thing I want people to think about is instead of thinking about sleep as how much time do I have left in my day to devote to this before my next day starts tomorrow, think about sleep as instead of the end of your day, think about sleep as the beginning of your next day, of tomorrow. So when I go to bed at night, I'm not thinking, well, how much left do I have to do? Because like, you know, many people, it's not anything special about me, but like many people, there's always more to do. But the question I ask myself is, how much sleep do I need? When do I need to go to bed in order to be functional as optimally tomorrow? And seeing sleep as an investment rather than a cost. And actually setting a timer or an alarm, whether an actual alarm or just having a time where whatever it is you're doing, it's time to start winding down, because you want to give yourself enough lead time. If you're driving a car and you need to stop at a stop sign, you don't start tapping the brake as soon as you're in front of the stop sign. Otherwise, you end up in the intersection. And that's right. What happens with people in bed, where they don't start slowing down till they're already in the intersection in bed. And so then what happens is that's not where they want to be doing that. That's not where you want to be slowing down. You need to start tapping your brakes a little earlier. You don't have to slam on your brakes. You can start tapping them a little bit, and it becomes a little less jarring. All those people who say they get into bed and they can't just shut their mind off, that to me sounds like people who are saying, you know, I tried stopping my car, but I keep winding up in the intersection. There must be something wrong with my brakes. There's nothing wrong with your brakes. You just need to start slowing down a little earlier, especially if you're going faster. The faster and harder you're going, the more lead time you need to give yourself. It's not your car's fault. It's not the brakes' fault. It's something you need to do behaviorally.
Right. So it's kind of building in that time to wind down. And then I think finding an activity to do during that wind down time so that you're not just picking up your phone again. Right. So
Exactly.
Yeah. Very, very good advice. Thank you. And where can people learn more about you and the study and your work?
We're both on, if people, you know, we're both relatively easily Googleable. We both have websites through our respective departments. I'll let Dr. Connick talk about what she's got. For us, I'm findable at michaelgrander.com or sleephealthresearch.com for our lab.
Yes, I'm findable at, I'm findable online. You just Google my name, Elizabeth Connick, C-O-N-N-I-C-K, and the Division of Infectious Diseases. And we have a website as well.
Right. Thank you. And I am findable at maliajacobson.com and at sleepwellstable.com. Thank you again, both, for joining me today. Happiest of holidays to you. Have a very safe and healthy season.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
It's the Sleep Well, Stay Well podcast. Now you know. Thanks for checking out the show.